Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a pivotal case out of New York, People v. Benjamin. For anyone trying to understand the Fourth Amendment's nuances around police stops and frisks, particularly when an anonymous tip is involved, this case is, well, it's a must-know.
Definitely.
It really gets to the heart of that tension between public safety and our rights against unreasonable searches, all hinging on this idea of reasonable suspicion.
Indeed. What we'll unpack for you today is the sequence of events in Benjamin, the foundational legal principles established by the Supreme Court in Terry v. Ohio, and then the specific reasoning that led the New York Court of Appeals to his decision.
Right.
The core of our discussion, and what's particularly relevant for you law students, is this. Under what circumstances can an anonymous tip, when combined with what a police officer observes, actually provide the legal basis to stop and even conduct a protective frisk of an individual? Benjamin offers some really key insights here.
Okay, let's get right into what happened. Picture this. It's October 27th, 1977, in Queens, New York. Officer Loran is responding to a radio call, and it wasn't exactly detailed, just men with guns.
Vague.
Very. When he arrives, it's not an isolated situation. There's a group of about 30 people gathered. Now, here's where things get interesting. As soon as the defendant spots the officers, he takes a step back and, crucially, reaches towards his waistband.
Ah, that movement. Yep. That movement is the linchpin of the case. Based on that specific action, Officer Loran conducts a pat-down and, well, he discovers a loaded revolver.
Right.
At the trial level, this weapon is admitted as evidence and the defendant pleads guilty.
Right.
But as you know, that's rarely the end of the legal road.
Exactly. The appellate division actually reversed that decision, arguing that the stop and frisk violated the Constitution. They essentially said the justification wasn't there.
Hmm.
But then the New York Court of Appeals stepped in and reinstated the original conviction.
And that reversal by the appellate division, followed by the Court of Appeals reinstating the conviction, really highlights the central question we need to explore. Generally, an anonymous tip by itself isn't considered reliable enough to justify a Terry stop.
Right. You don't know the source.
Exactly. So source is unknown, the information unverified. But in Benjamin, the defendant's own actions become critical in the court's analysis. They add that element of corroboration that the court found, persuasive.
So before we go further into Benjamin itself, let's take a step back and look at the bigger picture of Fourth Amendment law. We can't really understand Benjamin without talking about Terry v. Ohio from 1968.
Absolutely not.
That's the landmark case that gave us this concept of reasonable suspicion for these brief stops and frisks.
What's fascinating here is how Terry established a specific exception to the Fourth Amendment's usual requirement of probable cause for a full search or an arrest. Terry recognized that in certain situations, officers need to be able to briefly detain someone for investigation if they have a reasonable suspicion, a level of proof less than probable cause that criminal activity might be happening.
Okay.
And if they also have a reasonable suspicion that the person they've stopped might be armed and dangerous, Terry permits a limited pat-down for weapons.
Limited, though.
Limited. The crucial thing to remember is that this suspicion must be based on specific, articulable facts, not just a hunch or, a gut feeling. This lower standard of reasonable suspicion allows for brief investigatory stops, which is a lesser intrusion than the probable cause needed for an arrest or a full search.
And that brings us directly to a really important quote from People v. Benjamin. A stop and frisk must be founded on reasonable suspicion. An officer doesn't need to wait for a glint of steel before acting. That statement really captures the New York court's attempt to balance the need for officer safety with the protection of individual rights.
Precisely. And in Benjamin, the court heavily relied on what's known as the totality of circumstances test. This is a key concept in Fourth Amendment law.
Right. Look at everything.
It means that courts don't look at each individual fact in isolation. Instead, they consider all the circumstances surrounding the encounter as a whole to determine whether reasonable suspicion existed. So, what were the key factors that the New York court weighed in Benjamin?
Okay.
First, the nature of the anonymous tip. Even though it was anonymous, it reported an urgent situation. Men with guns.
Urgency matters.
It does. Second, the defendant's immediate reaction upon seeing the police, that backward step, coupled with a movement toward his waistband.
That specific action.
Yes. And third, something that's rooted in the realities of law enforcement. The officer's training and experience, and the common understanding that people frequently conceal firearms in their waistband. By looking at this whole picture, the court aimed to assess whether Officer Loran's suspicion was reasonable. This approach acknowledges that real-world situations are often complex and don't always fit neatly into predefined categories.
Okay, so the anonymous tip on its own wasn't enough that makes sense due to the inherent reliability issues with anonymous sources. We agree on that.
Generally, yeah.
But how did the defendant's specific action, reaching for his waistband, elevate that vague tip to the level of reasonable suspicion in the court's eyes?
Well, the key here is that the defendant's behavior provided a significant level of corroboration for the otherwise unreliable anonymous tip.
Corroboration.
Exactly. The gesture of reaching toward the waistband wasn't just any random movement. To a trained police officer, it's a specific action that strongly suggests the presence of a concealed weapon in a very common place to carry one. That action, in that context, responding to a report of men with guns, transformed the vague suspicion stemming from the anonymous call into a more concrete and articulable suspicion directed specifically at this individual. It wasn't just that he was there, it was how he reacted to the police presence in light of the tip.
And this idea of relying on common knowledge and the expertise of police officers is interesting. It sounds like the court is giving some weight to the on-the-ground judgment of law enforcement in these rapidly unfolding situations.
Absolutely. The court recognizes that police officers develop a certain level of expertise through their training and their experiences on the job. They become familiar with common behaviors and indicators that might suggest criminal activity, including the ways in which people often carry and conceal weapons.
Makes sense.
So when an officer observes a gesture like reaching towards the waistband immediately upon noticing law enforcement in an area where firearms were reportedly present, that observation carries more weight in the reasonable suspicion analysis than it might for someone without that training and experience.
Right.
As the majority opinion in Benjamin explicitly stated, it would be absurd to suggest an officer must await the glint of steel before acting. This really underscores the court's practical stance, acknowledging the need for officers to take reasonable steps to protect themselves and the public in potentially dangerous situations, even before they have absolute proof that a weapon is present.
So let's consider a slightly different scenario. What if the defendant had taken that step back when he saw the officers, but he hadn't made any movement towards his waistband? In that case, would the anonymous tip alone have been sufficient to justify a frisk?
Almost certainly not. In that hypothetical, you're left with an anonymous tip that, as we've discussed, generally lacks sufficient reliability on its own.
Okay.
Without any specific and suspicious behavior by the defendant that independently corroborates the idea that he might be armed, it would be very challenging for the prosecution to argue that the officer had the reasonable suspicion necessary to conduct a Terry stop, let alone a protective frisk.
So the gesture was key.
The waistband gesture was the crucial piece of corroborating evidence that tipped the scales in Benjamin. Absolutely critical.
Now, this totality of circumstances test, while it makes sense to look at everything together, does it face any criticism? It feels like it could potentially be interpreted, you know, subjectively.
That's a very valid point and a common critique of the totality of circumstances approach. Some legal scholars and commentators argue that its inherent flexibility can lead to inconsistent application by different courts, and that it might grant too much discretion to law enforcement officers in the field.
I can see that.
Critics suggest that this vagueness can make it difficult for individuals to understand exactly what conduct might lead to a police stop and frisk. However, the counterargument, which the New York Court of Appeals clearly embraced in Benjamin, is that policing often involves unpredictable and rapidly changing situations. Trying to create a rigid set of easily defined rules might not adequately account for the diverse realities that officers face on the ground and could potentially put them and the public at greater risk. The court sees this more flexible, contextual analysis as essential for dealing with the complexities of law enforcement.
So as we wrap up our discussion on People v. Benjamin, what are the key takeaways that our listeners, especially those law students grappling with the intricacies of the Fourth Amendment, should really understand from this case?
Okay, I think there are three primary principles to keep in mind. First, Benjamin powerfully illustrates that anonymous tips plus corroboration, reasonable suspicion.
Got it.
A tip that might initially be deemed unreliable, such as a general anonymous report, can gain significant legal weight when it's coupled with specific suspicious conduct that police officers observe firsthand.
The action matters.
It does. Second, the case highlights what's been referred to as the glint of steel doctrine. As the court explicitly stated, officers don't necessarily have to visually confirm the presence of a weapon before conducting a protective frisk, provided that reasonable suspicion exists based on a combination of other articulable factors.
So you don't need absolute certainty?
Not absolute certainty for the frisk, no. And finally, Benjamin really underscores the court's preference for the totality test versus bright line rules when evaluating these kinds of encounters. The court favored a comprehensive, case-by-case analysis of whether reasonable suspicion existed, rather than trying to establish a strict set of rules that would dictate the outcome in every conceivable situation.
So Benjamin isn't about giving the police unchecked authority, but it's also grounded in the practical realities of law enforcement. It seems to strike a balance, allowing officers to act when there are reasonable safety concerns, while still operating within the framework of the Fourth Amendment.
Precisely. It's about that delicate equilibrium between empowering law enforcement to address potential threats to public safety and protecting the fundamental liberties of individuals against unwarranted government intrusion in these often high-stakes dynamic situations.
Well, this has been an incredibly insightful deep dive into the case of People v. Benjamin. It really sheds light on a critical area of Fourth Amendment law concerning police stops and frisks, particularly the interplay between anonymous tips and observable behavior. It's fascinating how seemingly minor actions can have significant legal implications in the context of law enforcement encounters.
It certainly is. And it leaves us with a thought-provoking question for you to consider moving forward. Given the rapid advancements in communication and technology, how might these evolving landscapes impact the way we assess the reliability of anonymous tips and the significance of so-called corroborating behavior in future legal cases involving reasonable suspicion?
Good question.
Think about the implications of instant messaging, social media, and even sophisticated AI. What novel challenges might courts face in their ongoing efforts to balance public safety and individual rights when evaluating reasonable suspicion in light of these technological shifts? It's definitely a complex area to watch.